Welcome to Eric Stone Radio, the official podcast of Eric Stone Music. This is your host, Kevin B. Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 2. Here's Eric to talk about what's coming up.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to the second ever Eric Stone Radio podcast. On today's show in segment 1, we'll be exploring the performing singer-songwriter and what it takes to get out there and just do it. The background behind what I did to prepare myself for live shows and the mental aspect of performing in front of a crowd. In segment 2, Anatomy of a Song, we'll go in depth to the song 24 Meets 40, what inspired the song and how the story, the funny story behind how it came out accidentally. Anyway, welcome back to the second episode of Eric Stone Radio. Take it away, Kevin.
Well, all right, let's start out with a question, Eric. I've seen you perform many times, you know, at boat shows, house parties, private events, and one thing that always struck me is how comfortable you look up there on stage and how easily you get it done. Has it always been that way for you?
God, no. Man, the first time I ever performed, I almost threw up. It was in the fifth grade. I was in junior high in this kind of a Follies competition. And I'll never forget the song. It was Louisiana Saturday Night by Mel McDaniel. I'd already begun writing songs at the early age, but I'd never performed them live, so I figured I'd better do a cover tune that everybody recognizes. Maybe I could have a chance at winning. Well, it worked, and I did win the contest, but I'll never forget the butterflies I had when I started. It was like performing is the scariest thing in the world, and it can really get your goat. Most people are scared to take that leap, though. Some shouldn't. Some people should just write and never sing. But seriously, you know, I think everybody should get out there and do it. Some people just sing better than others. But seriously, you wouldn't believe how many talented, great guitar players, songwriters I've met over the years who have never played out live. It's mind-boggling. I've even written with a few guys who were embarrassed to sing in front of me during our writing session. It is, I guess, one of the hardest things to overcome. I've always played live, but it wasn't until I moved to Nashville that I really took the plunge.
Well, so what was it like when you first got to Nashville? Was it inspiring, scary, or what?
Well, all of the above. Let me tell you a story about my first night in Nashville. I've been working for Pitney Bowes at Kennedy Space Center in Cocoa Beach, Florida, and I was sent to a training class in Atlanta. Anyway, in class, I met a couple of guys who worked in the Nashville office, and I told them I've always wanted to move to Nashville and to become a better writer. And they told me that there were a few openings at their office and I should put in for a transfer. Well, as soon as I got home, I did exactly that. Within 2 weeks, I was heading to Nashville. My then-wife went ahead of me, and she secured an apartment, and I came up later with my moving truck. I got to Nashville about 2 p.m. on a Thursday night, and lo and behold, one of the guys in my class pulled up across the parking lot, and we recognized each other. We lived in the same freaking apartment complex, believe it or not. Anyway, he told me that there was a writer's night that night in a place called the Courtyard Cafe, and that I should go check it out. So later that night, I packed up my guitar in the truck, and I drove down there. I was a little apprehensive, to say the least, so I left my guitar in the truck just to check out the scene before I strolled in there like some great troubadour. Well, he was wrong. It wasn't a writer's night, but it was karaoke night. So since I was already there and I'd already ordered a beer, I figured I'd stick around and have a laugh. Every karaoke place I've ever been to had some of the worst singers I've ever heard, and it's kind of funny to drink a beer and listen to that. Anyway, so I sipped my beer, and I had my back to the stage, and I hear this Reba song come on, and it's like, wow, they're cranking. I never heard that version. I'm thinking to myself, wow, it's Reba does a different version of that song. And I turned around and I glanced at the stage and I saw a girl singing that Reba song. It was karaoke and they'd already started. It blew my mind. I was like, couldn't believe it. Then a guy got up and he did a version of Garth Brooks' song that even Garth Brooks would applaud for. And I was thinking, oh my God, this is overwhelming. I went home that night thinking, with my tail between my legs, thinking I had made a huge mistake. I am way outranked.
Whoa, that's got to be humbling.
Anyway, I finally got the courage to go back to the Courtyard Cafe during a real writer's night, and I signed up for it. I'm glad I did. The first night, I did 3 original songs and got some great feedback, which gave me confidence. Anyway, I also got to network with some great writers and managed to set up a few co-writing sessions, which is very, very important when you first get to Nashville. The more you write with better people that are better than you, the better it's going to make you, you know what I mean? So I ended up performing at every writer's night I could find in town, and I found the knowledge invaluable. I also secured a performing spot on a Friday night with a friend of mine at the Courtyard Cafe and with a friend of mine named Gary Schmitz, who became my duo partner for many years. Those were the days. Big money, man. $75 each and all the beer we could drink. That's where my song Beer Money came from, by the way. The funny thing is, we were one of the highest paid acts in town. Most other solo guys got $40 a night. It just goes to show what kind of competition there is in Nashville.
So it sounds like those early days really helped you hone your writing and performing skills. Can you go into a little more detail?
Yeah, well, performing in front of your peers in a town like Nashville, Music City, USA, not only will it intimidate you, but it'll humble you. If you get applause from those guys, I mean, if you can reach them, you can reach anyone. Nashville is a critical city. Pickers will berate you because they think they're better than you, or because mainly because they don't have the gig and they're jealous. But I don't have time for people like that. But it does thicken your skin, I will say. I would always think when someone was not showing respect, I'd go, well, I'm getting paid up here and you're sitting there drinking, listening to me. What does that tell you? Anyway, but there was so many great musicians, and some that were disgruntled and some that just loved to listen. And now with real fans, real music lovers, that's what it's all about. I am so grateful for anyone that will listen and applaud and out in the real world. And I live for that stuff, man. I love those folks. I love applause. I myself always applaud anyone who gets up there and has the guts to be on stage and perform live. And I always give a tip to performers. It's just something I do. It's just me, because I appreciate their effort and their guts to get up there and do it. You know, not everybody can do that.
Well, cool. That's a great perspective, Eric. Thanks. So it sounds like Nashville is a great town to learn in, but I'm sure you've had some disappointments there as well. Can you share some?
No doubt. One amazing skin thickening experience that comes to mind. I had a meeting with this publisher and I was pitching this new tune I wrote called I'll Quit Loving You Tomorrow. Anyway, I sat down in this reception area waiting for this big shot to let me in. The guy was a class act, to say the least. He looked like what you would think of a cartoon of a record company exec should look like. You know, flashy suit, cigar in mouth, the whole deal. Anyway, so after his many phone calls on my time, he finally called me into the office. I handed him the lyric sheet and a cassette demo of the song. Remember cassettes? Anyway, he popped it in and listened. He actually made it through the first chorus before stopping it. Now let me backtrack a bit. I had just come from another pitch meeting with the same song at another publishing company. That publisher told me that he loved the lyric, but he just did not like the melody and it seemed a bit dated. So back to the big shot, right? So he's kicking back and he said, well, you know, it's not really what we're looking for, sport. He went on to say, I really like the melody, but it seems fresh and new, but the lyric seems very dated. That's exactly the opposite thing the earlier publisher said to me. He said, let me hang on to it and let one of our staff writers listen to it. Maybe they can tweak it. You know, you never know. He might want to tweak it and he might want to core it with you. So it's a good thing to do. So I said, okay. Anyway, as I stood up and I walked out the door, I heard him crumble up my lyric sheet and throw it in the garbage. I almost turned around and cussed him, but I kept my cool. Anyway, the moral of the story is, I guess, sometimes it just boils down to personal taste. Not everyone is going to like the same song. Not everyone's going to like the same thing, right, Jalapeno Ray? Inside joke, but seriously. When you're pitching songs, don't give up. It'll take 100 no's to get a yes, and a yes could result in a number one song, and that you have to believe in.
Wow, that's a great story, Eric. I won't forget that visual of the fat guy behind the desk with the cigar. That's great. All right, we'll call that a wrap on segment one. Let's move on to the next segment. Segment two, Anatomy of a Song, where we're going to explore the song 24 Meets 40. All right, well, welcome to segment two. So, Eric, I'm glad you picked this song for the second podcast. It's a song I've always been curious about. I'm sure 24 Meets 40 has a hidden double meaning in there somewhere. Am I right?
You're exactly right, man. In the song 24 Meets 40, I explore the meeting of a young girl and an older man, a guy who just turned 40 and is going through some sort of midlife crisis, and he escapes by visiting this local bar where he meets young girls to recapture some of his youth. Now, the twist is that the bar is set in a location where I-24 intersects with I-40 in Nashville. These are real places. And after I wrote the song, there actually really is a little bar down there, and it looked almost exactly what I'd envisioned in my song. It's kind of weird, kind of freaked me out. Anyway, I didn't know it when I wrote it, but after I went there, it was very eerie and very weird.
So I understand you co-wrote that song with a guy named Irby Garrett. Tell us a little bit about the co-writing experience and about that session.
No worries. Yeah, Irby and I did a lot of co-writing together when I lived in Nashville. Co-writing is a great way to bounce ideas off each other, different songwriters, and go to places in a song that you may not have thought of. When you're signed to a publishing company, they actually expect it, and they set up co-writing sessions for you on a fairly regular basis. It also gets you to write with the writer who may be more experienced or a better guitar player or whatever. So anyway, back to that session with Irby. I went over to Irby's, and as usual, the first 30 minutes he just spent catching up, joking around or whatever, sharing songwriting ideas and stuff like that, what we like, what we don't like, that's new on the radio. And I often write songs while driving, so I may hear a tune or a talk show that inspires something, so I always carry a little micro recorder with me at all times, wherever I go. Anyway, I was explaining to Irby about this new song I came with as I was driving, and where the inspiration hit me. I said, you know, where I was driving, you know, where 24 meets 40? And he says, great song title. I said, no, that's not the song title. I was talking about a completely different song. I said, but then we kind of both look at each other and go, oh, 24 meets 40. That could be a song. So I was talking about a completely different song than Irby was when he thought of 24 meets 40, which is an actual highway intersection. So immediately we stopped and forgot that other song and started to write 24 meets 40. The song took shape in less than an hour. After several rewrites and a critique by songwriter teacher Jason Bloom, who said, and I quote, this song will end up on the radio and will be a hit. The song has been put on hold several times by several country artists and a pop boy band, but it never made the final cut. I know it's just a matter of time. So we'll see. We'll hang in there and let it go, you know? Let it ride the ride.
So I really like the intro to the song. Was this a song that the guitar riff drove the song, or did you write the song, then add the music after?
I am so glad you asked that. That is a very important question. As Irby and I were talking and trying to come up with a plan for a song, we both had our guitars in our laps, and we're just noodling, you know, playing little riffs or whatever. I was playing a G chord and kind of hammering the second string a little bit. Kind of happened by accident. And again, Irby says, nice intro. And I'm like, that's not an intro. And he's like, yeah, it sounds like a great intro for the song. And it turned out to be what happened, the intro. And it just kind of felt right. And that's the value of co-writing, because he heard something that I just kind of felt was background noise, didn't really pay much attention to it. But I've done the same thing with other writers. I hear something in their noodling and it sounds to me like an intro or something like that, a turnaround or whatever. So I think that's the beauty of co-writing, being with two people that have different opinions, different ideas, and you hear things completely differently, and that can really build a hit song.
Well, all right, let's play the song now. So here it is off Eric's CD, Legend of the Lost Soul. It's 24 meets 40.
Lordy, Lordy, look who's 40. Reads the banner above his desk. At the office party, he can hardly fake a smile, but he does his best. He ducks out quickly, heads for the city, where he's found comfort so many times before. He beats depression at the intersection of Highway 40 and 24. As he walks into that small bar just off the interstate, he's buying drinks for a girl he thinks is barely half his age. It's a place he knows he shouldn't be. A crossroads is just the same old story. While she's there for him to hold, he doesn't feel so old at the little bar where 24 meets 40. They start to slow dance, a happy hour romance, and he begins feel like a younger man. He barely knows her, but pulls her closer and holds on as tight as he can. Like two roads that come together, two lonely hearts collide. Driven to relive his youth, and she's along just for the ride.
in a place he knows he shouldn't be. A crossroads is just the same old story. But while she's there for him to hold, he doesn't feel so old. At a little bar where 24 meets 40, while she's there for him to hold, he doesn't feel so old. At a little bar where 24 meets 40.
Well, yeah, that is a great tune. I forgot how much I liked it. I hadn't listened to it in a while. And you're right about one thing, but it finally did make it on the radio. Eric Stone Radio, that is. And thanks for sharing the inspiration behind the song and the story about how it all came together. Well, okay, that wraps up segment two, Anatomy of a Song. Let's move on to the next segment, the questions and answers, where Eric will answer some of the questions you've submitted online. Okay, well, welcome to the segment where we answer listener questions. Eric, the first question today we have is from Jason in Alameda, California. Jason writes, "Hey, Eric, I've been listening to you for years. I've seen you a couple times here in Alameda at the Bolina Bay Yacht Club. Anyway, my question is, how do you make that electric guitar of yours sound so acoustic? Is it the electronics pedals on the ground you use? It's always intrigued me. Thanks, Jason."
Jason, I get that question all the time. When I tell people, sometimes they don't believe me, but it is true. It has nothing to do with my foot pedals. It's the guitar itself. It's a handmade electric hard body with acoustic pickups under the bridge. It's made by a company in Orlando, Florida called Guitar Factory. They call them EA Hybrids, which is basically two guitars in one. I bought my first one way back in 1989. I own three of them now. They are incredible instruments. Anyway, they have a neck-through design with a little hollowing in the body, and they install a Fishman active transducer pickup under the bridge. It gives it this amazingly realistic acoustic sound. It sounds better than some real acoustics that are plugged in, I kid you not. And I've heard that from other people. So that's about it, Jason. No tricks or anything up my sleeve. It's the real deal, man. But as far as my pedals, I just use those basically for a little reverb or modulation and, of course, distortion and gain when I'm playing on my electric channel side of my electric guitar. But thanks for the question. What you got next, Kevin?
Okay, the next question is from Mike in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mike says, "Hi, Eric. I saw you on your summer tour when you came through Albuquerque with Kim at a house concert. I bought two of your CDs. The question I have is about a song on Time to Fly. I know you write a lot of songs about real events. Is the song Jimmy's Drive-In about a real person? It's an amazing story. I hope you get back through Albuquerque next summer. If you do, let us know and we'll be there. Sincerely, Mike."
Mike, I really enjoyed playing Albuquerque, by the way. Great folks. Jimmy's Drive-In is it's about a real guy I met in St. Thomas. He's an avid scuba diver, and I've dove with him many times. He's a pretty wild man. He's a great guy to hang around. His story is all true. He had a rough life growing up in Texas, but he's living the dream now. He dives nearly every day and lives on this sweet trawler in Elephant Bay between Water Island and St. Thomas. Jimmy, in real life, is as much of a character as he is in the song. He loves diving and loves his Heinekens, if you know what I mean. He's a real happy, fun guy to be around. Okay, Kevin, do we have time for one more?
You bet. Last one was sent in from Mark, actually up in your neck of the woods, Eric, in Marathon, Florida. Mark writes, "Hey, Eric, I saw you at Salty's in January. Wow, what a show. You rocked the place. I was wondering, do you play mostly bar gigs or private parties or what, and what do you prefer doing? Also, how does someone go about booking you? Just curious. Mark."
Hi, Mark. Yeah, I play a mix of house concerts, bar gigs, private parties, boat show concerts, set up my guitar on the side of the street and put a bucket in front of me. No, not really. Anyway, I have to say my favorite things to play are house concerts. Although Salty's gig was exceptional. It was in my first podcast, I talked about having a great moment where I played all originals. Well, that's where it was, Salty's. Wow, what a bunch of great cruisers that came out to hear us that night. As far as booking me, you can just go to islanderic.com and click the booking tab. All the info is there. The reason I like house concerts so much, though, is because the people go there, they go to listen to the music, not to talk, not to just chit-chat and pick up girls or whatever, you know what I mean? It's not like a bar scene. It's kind of like playing the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville. It's on their menu at the Bluebird, they have a picture of someone holding their finger down that says, shh. You know what I mean? To be quiet and listen, that's what you're supposed to do. Sometimes it's just too hard to get people's attention when they're in a bar socializing. I also tend to sell a whole lot more merchandise at house concerts. It's very satisfying. It's also a great way to get closer to the fans and connect. Thanks for all the great questions, y'all. And remember, you can send your questions to AskEric at EricStoneRadio.com. Well, what do you have in store for the next podcast, Kevin?
Well, Eric, on the next podcast episode we've got coming up, we're going to explore the song Huma Huma Unuka Uka Up Up. Whatever that is. You know, the Triggerfish song, the one you wrote in Hawaii. Really catchy tune.
Cool, brah. That was a cool time. See you on the flip side. Mahalo and Okale Maluna. That means bottoms up. See you out there.
All right. Well, that's a wrap for this episode of Eric Stone Radio. Remember, if you have questions you'd like Eric to answer on the air, give us an email at askeric, all one word, at ericstoneradio.com. Till next time, this is your host, Kevin B. Thanks for listening to the Eric Stone Radio Podcast. The Eric Stone Radio Podcast is copyright 2013 Eric Stone Music and is distributed under fair use copyright rules. The Eric Stone Radio Podcast is produced by Two Block Studio, Palo Alto, California. For Eric Stone Radio, this is Kevin B.